The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Raised in a home that respected and indeed expected family members to contribute as public servants and to take an active role in their communities, Nancy Pelosi was already on the road to power when, as a 47-year-old mother of five, she ran for a seat in the United States Congress for California's 8th District and, of course, won. 20 years later, in 2007, she broke the marble ceiling of the United States Capitol and became the highest-ranking elected woman in American history and the first female Speaker of the House, second in line to the presidency. Speaker Pelosi shares her remarkable journey from homemaker to House Speaker in Know Your Power, a message to America's daughters, which she co-wrote with Amy Hill Hearth. She's inspired many women to speak out and make our voices heard and to focus on what matters most to us. As the mother of five children and now grandmother to seven, she's respected equally for her devotion to her family as well as to the founding principles of this country, which, as we all know, were agreed upon just a short distance from where we all sit tonight. Speaker Pelosi will be interviewed this evening by our own Tamala Edwards, who anchors the morning edition of 6ABC's Action News. And it gives me great pleasure at this time to welcome both Speaker Pelosi and Ms. Edwards to the Parkway Central Library. Please join me in welcoming them.
Thank you and welcome. I was telling the speaker it's quite something to sell out the Free Library, but to sell out the Free Library on a Tuesday night is really something.
In the summer.
In the summer. And for myself, I'm technically on vacation this week. I should have curly hair and be in running shoes. But it is a sign of how important and special I think this particular author is that I wanted to be here tonight. And, of course, you know that I'm joined by Madam Speaker Pelosi. And so let's get started. The book is Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. And, of course, the question authors often get, especially with memoir or advice, is why did you write this book? And as I was thinking about the book, Madam Speaker, I thought about some of the stories you told in the environment you grow up in. Your mother, Annunciata, is 19 when she meets your father. And he loves her, but thinks no business deals. He doesn't like that. You know, she comes up with the idea for a face steamer, which I think is brilliant. You'd be sitting on millions now.
No.
But she stays back. She helps him run the city and raise six children. You also talk about the environment. She wanted you to be a nun. You're able to go to Trinity College in Washington because it's, you think, well, it's all women and it's close by. So that's the environment in which you're a teenager and in which you're growing up. The environment today, we've had our first female candidate run for president in a viable, truly viable way. We've had not one but two female Supreme Court justices, and we now have our first female House Speaker. What made you think, those environments being so different, that this book, you still thought there's a need for advice to America's daughters with that sea change visible?
Thank you very much, Tamala, for sacrificing part of your holiday. I mean, in awe that anybody would do this. But I thank all of you for giving your time and coming this evening so that we can engage in a conversation about America's daughters and my lessons to them. You had a lot of questions there, and so before I answer any of them, I want to say how delighted I am to be in Philadelphia. My husband went to Malvern Prep for a senior year in high school, became close to the Wolfington family, some of whom are here, Lindsay, this evening, and so we spend a lot of time here in Avalon, New Jersey, over the last 40-some years. My friend Mark Arantik is here this evening, and I'm so pleased that he is, and I thank all of the leadership, Bill Sasso, Linda Johnson, so many of you who have been a part of this great institution. And my first official civic involvement, was to be a library commissioner in San Francisco. I'll tell you that story later. It's in the book, but I'm very close to libraries, so it's really an honor and a pleasure for me to be here with my daughter, Christine Pelosi, who is with me today. The atmosphere that I grew up in, yes, different from today, and yes, we have a candidacy for president. We're very proud of a candidate who could be president and demonstrated that to the American people with intellect, political savvy, stamina, and all that it takes. And it was showed that a woman was ready, and it showed that the American people were ready. The justices of the Supreme Court you named, and well, we have one now, but nonetheless we've had two, and the Speaker of the House, and some other progress. But what I'm thinking of is not some examples, no matter how high up. I'm thinking of a wave of empowerment for women in their personal lives, in their professional lives, and hopefully in the political life of our country. I know, despite some of the progress that you pointed out, that nothing has been more wholesome for the political process and government in our country than the increased participation of women in that process. And I know that there are not enough women in positions of power and leadership there. When I came to Congress, there were 20 women. It was 21 years ago. 20 women. Now, let me add, out of 435 members of Congress. And now they're about 80. I've made it one of my missions to increase the number of women in Congress, and I'm so proud of Allison Schwartz, who was with us earlier this evening, and thank you for sending her to Congress. Think of that, Allison Schwartz, a member of Congress, adding to our numbers. But the Pennsylvania delegation did not have a woman member. So just think of the immediate impact on the delegation. I'm saying on the Democratic side. We did not have a Democratic woman. And so the influence of women, especially younger women raising families, to have that point of view firsthand at the table, at the seat of power, it sends to America's working women, young working women, your voice is heard there. As someone who shares your experience, your aspirations, your day-to-day struggles, and your challenges. So again, it's nice and to be proud. It's nice to be proud of some of the accomplishments we have. Women have helped women be empowered at these high levels. But I know there's a great unleashing that this country is ready for, of just a whole new generation of women being involved. And when I say a whole new generation, I don't necessarily only mean age-wise. I came to Congress when I was 47 years old, and when I did, people said, she came to Congress late in life. And now we have a candidate for president who just turned 47 yesterday, and I say, he's too young. He's so young to be president. That's all a perspective, I guess. But in any event, now that some of my children are in their 40s, it seems very young to me. But that is after I had raised my children. I'll go more into it about women and the questions I have for them. But when I was growing up, yes, somebody asked me yesterday, what did you want to be when you were 10 years old? I said I wanted to be playing with my toys and going to the beach and doing my homework. But didn't you know what you wanted to be when you grew up? I said no. But my mother knew. She knew I wanted to be a nun. God did not bless me with that vocation, but more on that in a moment.
As you can see, you're in for a very entertaining hour. You mentioned that that was one of the opening parts of the book. You mentioned you're 47, had raised 5 kids as you come to Congress. Sally Burton, your friend, is dying, and she says, "I want you to take my seat." But now, you had taken on some interesting roles before then, beginning as a volunteer, but steadily taking more prominent, visible roles in the Democratic Party. Do you think you would have run anyway? Was it already in your mind, or really she gave you that nudge?
Let me tell you very intimately, and if you don't tell anybody, I'll be happy about that. I was a very shy person. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was to get in front of an audience. Did anyone ever have that feeling in this room? And then especially when I became chair of the California Democratic Party, and I was a behind-the-scenes person. Mark knows this role in politics. You're promoting other candidates. But when it comes time to promote yourself, well, that's just a whole different thing. I used to say I can bake the pie or I can sell your pie. But it's very hard for me to sell my pie. But you know, self-promotion, it's a terrible thing, but you find somebody has to do it. And so in any event, I got used to that because I believed in the issues that I was trying to promote, and I knew that I had to take some responsibility. Let me be very clear, because I think it's important for women to know this, or anyone, but especially women as you make your decisions. I had absolutely no intention ever of running for political office, A. B, when Sala asked me, I said, "Sala, why are you asking me? I've never expressed any interest in running for political office." She said, you love the issues. You always are interested in issues. You can work on the issues instead of just promoting other people. You can do, as a volunteer, you can do this now in your own right. What was interesting to me is this has happened before. Men have chosen their successors or have anointed someone that they would like to see follow in their footsteps. But I don't think you can find any other place where a woman member of Congress has said, "I want another woman to follow in my footsteps." So it was quite a remarkable challenge, she being a dear friend and a person I had supported in politics. It was a giant compliment to me. But it was very serendipitous, as is my whole entire route to the Congress. And that's why I wrote the book. People ask me over and over again, "How on earth did you raise 5 children, mind you, born in 6 years when we brought our baby home from the hospital, our 5th baby child?" My oldest daughter was turning 6 that week. So it's challenging. And I have enormous respect for moms raising families. Moms know it's glorious, it's joyful, it's the greatest thing in the world. It's constant. And the skills that you hone, discipline and diplomacy and personal interactions and logistics and quartermaster and, you know, food and driving and all the rest of it, to balance all of that, and not for one second taking your eye off the children. If you can do that, you can do anything. That was my attitude. I don't know if I've answered your question.
For people who don't know, you come from a political family. Your father was the mayor of Baltimore. Your brother Tommy, also the mayor of Baltimore. And you mentioned, even in the green room, that the family had high expectations of Tommy as going far in politics. Is there, do you think, a part of the family, your father's spirit, that's still surprised that it's Nancy who's the Speaker of the House and not Tommy?
Well, I don't know. In Baltimore, being mayor of Baltimore is a pretty big deal. And that was what my father had been. He loved, of all the opportunities he had in life, he was madly in love with the city of Baltimore, and that was, to him, reaching your heights. My brother Tommy, he was actually groomed for politics. And I was not groomed. I mean, I was groomed to do whatever I felt like doing, which to me was great. You know, that was great, except once my mother got over that I did not have a vocation. But it is, let me tell you this story, because it's just a little series of serendipitous events that somehow or other I was ready for and had to make a decision about. The first one is that my first official involvement, as I mentioned, was to be a commissioner, a library commissioner. So I'm so thrilled to be here, and I salute the leadership of the library here because of what they've done in the branch libraries and first, and then coming to do the central library. That's a remarkable thing and speaks to the a commitment to the community that this board, both the board, the foundation, the library board have. So I have these 5 children in 6 years. We have a routine, part of the routine was in the afternoon they were out playing and I was getting organized inside, and that was my chance to read the paper. So I'm reading the paper in the afternoon, and the phone rings, and it's the mayor of San Francisco, Joe Eliotto, a person not unlike my father, progressive in his politics but conservative in his attitudes toward family life and the rest. So this great mayor says to me, "Hi, Nancy, this is Mayor Eliotto, Joe Eliotto." He lived 3 doors from me. I could practically hear him. My husband had grown up with some of his older children. My brother and he were mayors at the same time. So I knew him. So what are you doing? Making a great big pot of pasta fagioli? And I said, "No, Mr. Mayor, I'm reading the newspaper." So I said, "Well, I'm calling to ask you if you'd appoint you to the Library Commission." Now, lesson. My response: "Oh, no, Mr. Mayor, I love the library, and I will always be a volunteer there. I don't need the title. Why don't you give the title to someone else who won't work unless they have the title?" Now, that was being a girl, right? So he said, "That's ridiculous. You know, you love the library, you love the librarian, the city librarian was a friend of mine, and we need your vote on the library commission. And besides, one day you may run for a public office, and it would be great to have a credential that you're a city commissioner." I'm never, Mr. Mayor, I am never, mark this down, I am never running for political office. Well, anyway, think about it, and then I accepted the honor, which I loved. It was about branch libraries and the central library, and it was about building a new library. And I hope you all get behind the effort to the drive to replace or expand on this facility, recognizing the technological demands that information, the spread of information, sharing of information requires. Because this is democratic; it's patriotic, democratic with a small D, and patriotic. That people will have access to the information the most serviceable way to them and free. So, and I went on the Library Commission. I loved it because people wanted to know what my opinion was. I had a vote. This made all the difference in the world. And we took our meetings out to the library, to the branch libraries, and we did something different, and it was great. So that was one. Next, a couple of years later, Jerry Brown, the governor of California, new governor, we're in the middle 70s now, Jerry Brown, most of you were not born. It's a remarkable thing when I look in the room and think I'm older than anybody in the room. But in any event, he decides he wants to run for president of the United States, the newly elected governor, 2 years governor of California. And he wants to run for president. Well, he had a big reputation in terms of being a newly elected Democratic governor of California and the rest, but not a whole lot of people were thinking of him in terms of running for president of the United States. He was. And so I said, I called our mutual friend, the Speaker of the House, the Assembly there, Leo McCarthy. I said, "Leo, it's going to be over by the time June comes in California. They're going to have a nominee. There's not going to be any opportunity for Jerry Brown even to control his own party in California because people will go with the person who's going to be president of the United States." Now, in Maryland, the Secretary of State has said that any candidate who is recognized as a candidate for president in any state of the union will be put on the Maryland ballot, And so and that person can take his or her name off, but it's on the ballot unless they do. So let's go to Maryland. You know, my father, my brother, my friends, this, that, all of the people that can help us organize a campaign, let's go to Maryland and make a fight. And so this, my, now Jimmy Carter's winning all these places. It had nothing to do against Jimmy Carter. It was just about Jerry Brown and the ideas that we had about the future. So anyway, Jerry Brown comes, we put on a campaign, it grew and grew and grew. It was Obama-like in this feature. Every place we went, we had to keep enlarging the venue. People, hundreds and hundreds of people would turn out every place, and they were very excited about this new, fresh voice in the party. And lo and behold, we won. Now, this made me more on the subject of Marilyn and Jerry Brown in 1976, but how it relates to me is, so we go back to California for this, and then he won in other states. He didn't win delegates. He was too late for delegates. He won the popular vote. But this was a big thing because Jimmy Carter had just won Pennsylvania just a month before, and that was a big victory for him. And everybody thought, Jimmy Carter wins Pennsylvania, it's all over. And, of course, it almost was. But nonetheless, we went. We go back to California. We have a big, big victory celebration. Oh, my gosh, it's so exciting. Jerry Brown stands up and says, Nancy Pelosi was the architect of my Maryland campaign. And so there I went from the kitchen with one step out the door because I became a member, a delegate, a member of the Democratic National Committee, the northern chair of the party, and then the chair of the party, and one thing led to another until this incident that Tamala mentions when the congresswoman took ill and asked me if I would run. Again, very serendipitous because she was in good health, and then she wasn't. She was diagnosed and went quickly, and I had to make a quick decision, and I'll tell you about that decision if you ask.
But anyway, I think that's called leading the interview.
The issue is just be ready. Be ready and measure these opportunities. Sometimes there's an opportunity there and sometimes maybe not. But be ready. That's part of my message.
But Madam Speaker, what does it mean to be ready? When it happens to you, you don't see it coming. What had you done before then to be ready? And what would you say to people out here, a mother with three kids who can never imagine being in Congress? What does she do to be ready?
Well, the thing is that what does being a mom prepare you to be a member of Congress? Of course, I was an informed citizen. I read constantly. I knew the issues. I supported other candidates. So I was on the periphery, and then as chair of the party, more than on the periphery, but not in the electoral way. And I have a phrase in the book, and one of the chapters is, age quod agis, do what you're doing. Oh, that was Latin, in case you didn't recognize, in case I didn't say it right. Do what you're doing, and then place a value on that, whether it's raising a family or involved in your profession. You don't have to have political experience to be able to make a contribution that is different and unique and necessary. And that's really part of my message, too, is especially to women, is we really need you. You know your power. Be able to use your power and know how necessary it is for the future of our country. So we don't need sameness. We don't need the same credentials or the same path. We need diversity of opinion. And don't let anybody diminish your credential because it doesn't resemble their credential. Because what's special about you is there's nobody like you. And your voice will add something new and different to the discussion. So, need I go into again what it takes and how constant and focused you have to be to raise a family? The most challenging endeavor you can engage in. My friend Lindsay has five little children now. Of course, she was a school teacher, so she knows how to organize them. But it is, and it's coalition building. My daughter Christine always reminds me that, and I talk about it a little bit in my book about my own coalition building among my brothers. In other words, the two of us may have something going against the four of them, and then the next day it's three of us against three of them in terms of, and then maybe one day all of us against our parents. But but if anybody has siblings in the room or multiple siblings, you know how sometimes these relationships can go. But don't just say, well, I haven't done all the public policy things. value what you have done. And maybe your contribution is not to run, but to support others to run or to advance causes that are about the future and about our... See, I see it all through the prism of children. I see my role in politics as an extension of my role as a mom. If you do that too, your credentials are impeccable. So give it a value, and don't let anyone minimize what that is. But, you know, you have to have a passion for it, and that passion comes from your knowledge of the issues and how you think you can make a difference. But I have every confidence that the women of America have an enormous amount to bring to the table. So I want to see this wave, this unleashing, and not just these examples.
One of the things that we all have to deal with at some point, and it's no fun, is failure. And in the book, you write about some races before you became speaker, where not only do you deal with failure, you deal with what it means when old friends turn on you. And so I wondered, what did you learn from those moments, and what did you take forward?
Well, in the book, one of the things I want to say first, and then I'll go to me, but generally, several years ago, I received an honorary degree from an American Conservatory Theater, which teaches young people how to be actors and dramatists and directors and the rest in San Francisco. And before I spoke, before I received mine, the person who produced, directed and wrote M. Butterfly on Broadway received an award, a young man, very talented. And so all the kids wanted to know from him, what is it like to be a success on Broadway? And so when he got up to speak, he said, you've all asked me that question, but here's what I want you to know. Sometimes you must beware of success. You learn a lot from failure. So when you fail, it's very, very quiet. It's so quiet. Nobody calls. When you go to someplace, nobody comes over to talk to you. Your phone doesn't ring. It's very, very quiet. But when you succeed on Broadway, you're the toast of the town. Your phone never stops ringing. Bells, whistles. You go to a party, the center of attention. Everybody wants to be with you. There's so much noise and bells and all the rest. There's so much noise. You can't hear what's in your heart, which is what got you there in the first place. And so we have to understand the challenges of success as well as the lessons of failure. Well, we have a motto in our book that says, organize, don't agonize. You just have to move on from any of these things. You just have to move on. And you learn from it. And again, it's all a kaleidoscope. We're all a resource to it. And in politics, it's not for the faint of heart. Don't let me give you this impression that people are waiting with open arms to pull you into power. Nobody has ever, in the history of the world, given away power. It's something that is hard fought for and competed for. And men have to compete for it, too, much of the time. So understand that you're going into the ring. You're in the arena, and you have to take all the knocks. You have to, forgive me for sounding this way, but this is what it is. You have to be able to throw a punch, and you have to be able to take a punch once you throw one. And so when I say throw a punch, you have to assert yourself. And you can't be afraid of people saying, oh, the woman acting that way, you know what she is. Forget them. And you know the phrase, modesty forbid? Forget that, too. Forget all about that. But it is tough because people have other relationships. Just because they're your friend doesn't mean they might not be a better friend to somebody else, and that it might suit their purpose at that time to be for the other person. But again, I learned from that. If I hadn't run, I ran for national chairman and I lost. If I hadn't run for that, I would never have been ready to run for Congress. Now, that's not a public office. That's a party office. And running for state chair and running for that, they're party office. But that's not as a public thing where you go into the public and ask for votes. So, but when I did that, I knew to expect the people that had been my friends, my political associates, and the rest over time might not be able to be there for me. And it was just a question of how vicious they would be. Because when you get in a fight, you're in a fight. But I try to keep mine on the high ground and not engage in that. That's why I said, just organize. Just keep organizing. And that sense of organization that you learn being a mom, that sense of focus and discipline and organization served me well. I knew exactly what I had to do. I knew what the timetables that I had to do it in and the rest. It was almost instinctive. And instinctive, since I've used that word, I want to say this. Everybody has talked now. Some young women may not have heard this phrase, but in my day, they would say, I'm still in my day, right, Christine? But when I was young, they would say a woman's intuition. They would talk about a woman's intuition. You've heard that phrase. It's a real thing. Women have an intuition, an intuitive sense about what is right, what will work in a time frame. And that's very valuable. And it's a quality of leadership that not everyone has, but that women bring to the table in bountiful supply. So when you're thinking of that, add that. When you're taking inventory of your strengths, put that on there too. Legislators have a tendency to think in deductive ways. Or we'll have meetings, we'll have hearings, we have votes. There's this. A leader has to make a decision. And you have to make a decision in real time sometimes. So bringing that leadership skill to whatever elective office, be it legislative and the rest, some of the training that people have had, you know, they talk about people, I've been there, that some of the training that they have had is the reverse training than what we need. You know, they're thinking longer term. We're thinking of the future, but prepared to make decisions based on knowledge, a vision for the future, knowledge and judgment that knowledge brings to you, a plan on how to get it done, and a way to attract people to it when they see your passion for it. But that intuitive sense, put that way up there as something where you have an advantage because it's a fresher, more common sense approach to it. I'll talk about the secret sauce later if you want, about why men talk about the secret sauce.
In your book, you mention a lot of what you keep in the forefront of your mind as you do your work is thinking about children, America's next generation. So I'll ask you the question that I always get from children, especially when they see someone like yourself who's in a position of power. Do you ever get scared? You're walking in to see the president. Yeah. You're going on TV with Tim Russert or others, the former moderator of Meet the Press. You're going in to tell some of your colleagues, and you're not going to get what you want. And they're angry. Do you ever get scared?
People always ask me the word, are you afraid that? I said, just strike that word from your vocabulary when you're talking to us here, because this is not for the faint of heart, as I've said. This is not for the faint of heart. You can't be afraid. You have, a vision, a knowledge, a plan. You have support. You're in there to make the fight if this is what you believe in. And That's what you have. So when you say afraid to go into, what, do you have stage fright? That's a little bit different than losing a fight over an issue. But you just have to make the fight, because if you show one cent of being afraid, your options are destroyed. So you have to believe in what you are doing. And you may not win every fight, but you will advance the cause. So how do you do this in a way? How do you do this in a way that everybody knows it's only a matter of time? This is going to happen. We may not have won today. And let me say, Washington, D.C. is a city that is wedded to the status quo. Change is not what they're about. It just, they aren't. And when I went for leadership, it was because I thought, you must be kidding. The American people have these needs and challenges and aspirations and hopes and dreams. And this is a city that is wedded to the special interest because they all make a living perpetuating the status quo. It's the special interest, not the people's interest. And that's why it was so important, if I may have a moment of partisan enjoyment, that we won with Mark Aronchick and Alison Schwartz and Chaka Fatah and Bob Brady and so many others helping us, that we won the last election, because I said, I am an outsider. I'm becoming Speaker of the House, not because I've mastered the inside game. I can do that. But because I'm an outsider and I want change to happen here. We need disruption. We need disruption. This incrementalism, well, we'll throw you a crumb and we'll keep the status quo, is not the American way. Our founders, this city, where it all started, they were disruptors. They were disruptors. So I sometimes you wonder why you have to go to such lengths to convince people of the obvious about the future. My whole thing is about children. What does this decision mean for children? And then it's pretty clear the route we should take. But you can't be afraid. I mean, you might have your apprehension about... one of the things I learned from my parents and my father's knee was know how to count the votes. You have to know how to count the votes so that you can figure out how you get the votes and then you'll win. But if you're prepared, be ready. If you're prepared, you have your best chance of either winning or setting yourself up, as I said, for the next putt. You're going to get it in the next time. The little girls, people ask me about little girls, and sometimes they come. They've been coming to the book parties, some especially the ones that are a little earlier in the day. And the thing about the little girls that is so wonderful is that they're being raised by parents who have a different orientation to little girls. And the notes I get from parents of little girls, especially interesting to me, is the fathers of daughters. They just are saying, thank you so much for your breaking the marble ceiling has helped my daughter have many more possibilities. Or I know my daughter has the talent to do anything, and now she has more openings to do so. And as I said to some folks last night, I was at the Kennedy Library in Boston last night about little girls. Listen to them. If you want to give a little girl self-esteem, listen to what she has to say. That example is not, you're wonderful. Let me tell you how wonderful you are. Let me tell you what you should do. That's good. But what do you think? What do you think? And just to listen to them as they express themselves and the rest says more about your respect for them than almost anything that you can do. And they are, I mean, I know, I have seven grandchildren, six boys, one girl. And our little daughter, my grandson, what is the definition of a genius? Anybody who has a grandparent, right? They're all fabulous. But I think people are seeing that these little girls, they're ready to run the show. And I don't say this to the detriment or diminishment of the contribution of men. That's fabulous, too. But you can't have it so one-sided. It just can't be in the United States of America or in the world. The world is actually ahead of us in terms of the participation of women in leadership positions. So I want those little girls to feel all the encouragement in the world that they can do anything that they set out to do. And you know what? Anything I tell you and what you read in the book, it's not going to be new to you. You know this. I'm just reaffirming it or endorsing it because this is very simple. It's all there. It's all there for the taking or the exploiting of an opportunity.
We're obviously in a very interesting political year from the primaries on out. And I wonder what it was like for you being the first female speaker and watching these two capable candidates, charges of sexism and other things were flying, even Katie Couric, the first female anchor of a solo news show, is saying she sees sexism. What was it like for you to watch this race? Did you agree with that charge? Was it odd being a leader who's saying, I shouldn't jump in, I should wait until the people have selected their candidate? Yeah. Did you want to jump in? Take that ball,
well,
speaker.
Well, see, the thing is this, of sexism exists in our society. There's no question about that. It's fairly pervasive, and it's not regional. But it's so... don't agonize, organize. You know, okay, the best way to persuade people of another point of view is to win, is to prevail. You know, is to prevail. Now, I saw signs of this all along in my career. You can just imagine a mother of five without going through the chairs of running for this and running city council, state legislature, this or that, just running for Congress and then running for Speaker. That you can just imagine the trivialization, the minimizing of my credentials that they did. But I couldn't let that bother me. I didn't let it be a factor in what I set out to do. I didn't set out to do anything, so I guess that's the way it was. But I did not let it, when confronted with it, And they have terrible names that they can call women that resonate with people and give some people a comfort level. Okay, we don't have to worry about her. But I want to say this to the women. They would not do that if they were not concerned about your effectiveness. If they thought you weren't going to win or weren't going to be effective, they wouldn't be acting in that way. But it's a way to deal with something that is new to them, which is the increased empowerment in a very important way of women. Do I think the question I mostly get asked, did that make the difference in the election? I don't know. I haven't studied the statistics of the race and the rest, but there are many factors that go into how an election is won or not won. And a lot of it is redundant. What you do is redundant, and you don't know what's redundant until after the election to see what worked or didn't. But I do think that whatever the outcome, that Hillary Clinton removed all doubt in anyone's mind that a woman can be president, that the American people are ready for it, and that it's just a matter of time, a short period of time, either for her or for someone else. And there are many, many capable women who are possible candidates for president in the near future. But just running and coming so close is not a setback. It's a giant, giant advance. No, I was the chair of the I'm the chair of the convention. It was my responsibility to be neutral in the election. I had House members on the Hillary side. I had House members on the Barack side. And I said, I'm for my House members. So.
All right. And I think at this point,
well,
Andy,
I just want to tell you, because one thing about listening to the little girls, I wanted to tell you this one story, because I think it captures a lot of what we're talking about here. So when you go to Congress, and there are not so many women, there's, well, 40 to 1 men, women, they have a tendency to talk to each other, and you know, without necessarily turning and saying, did you have anything you wanted to say? Or unless you barged in, if that's the way it was. And we used to go out to dinner on Tuesday nights. We had a group. Tom Folietta from Philadelphia was part of that group. And we would go out to dinner. It would be probably about a dozen men, sometimes 20, and three of us. Barbara Boxer, who's now a senator, but she was in the House then. Barbara Kennelly, who was a member from Connecticut, and then I joined the group when I came to Congress. And so we would go out to dinner, and it was just a phenomenal thing, because these men would just talk to each other and talk over each other and interrupt each other. And that's the way members of Congress talk to each other. You should notice, I would go home, I'd have to adjust myself, because I'd start doing that too, interrupting people, cutting people off, just changing the subject, anything I wanted to talk about. But that's the way it is. And it used to be. So they, it wouldn't even occur to them in 100 million years to say, what do you think of that? And unless you wanted to, barge in and do that, you weren't in the conversation. So one night we're at dinner, and they start talking about childbirth. They start talking about childbirth. Now, Barbara, I have 5. Barbara Kennelly had 4. Barbara Boxer had 2. 11 among the three of us, 11 children. And so we're sort of looking at each other thinking, for surely they'll turn around and say, does this conversation make you uncomfortable? Or what do you think about this? Instead, here's the conversation. Oh, yeah, well, on my first one, they wouldn't let me in the room. I got all suited up in the green gown or the blue gown or whatever it was. I got all ready, but the doctor wouldn't let me in the room. I was furious. I was listening at the door. I had the camera and the rest of it. It was hard. It was a hard labor. Yeah, and then the next one. I have my camera. They let me in, not for the first, but for the second. Times changed anyway. They let me in for the second. I have my camera. I had on the gown, the thing, the hood, the whatever. Doctor, the cap, you know what they look like. I go in with the camera. I got all these pictures. My wife was not happy. She didn't want me taking those pictures, but I wanted to take the pictures. You want to see the pictures one day? No, we don't want to see the pictures. So, and then the next one, Well, I could go in. I know the doctor. We went to school together, the rest of it. I could go in. I got in there, almost fainted. I said, get me out of here. Get me out of here. Get me out. And all the while saying, at least they included the woman. We really had a hard labor, right? We. So we're looking at each other thinking, you know, this is so typical of them that they don't even have a clue that three women are sitting here. We might not want to even hear a conversation about the delivery of babies, you know? It means something different to us than it does to them with their cameras and their blue gowns and their fainting spells and the rest. So another couple of weeks go by. We're at dinner at a friend's house, and there's a congressman named Don Edwards, who was the floor leader of the ERA, a beautiful, lovely man, the chair of the Constitutional Subcommittee of Judiciary, and we're talking about one thing and another, and he says to me, what do you think, Nancy? I said, oh, my God. He said, well, why are you reacting that way? So I told him the story that I just told you, and all these same people are at the table. And they said, that could never possibly have happened. We would never have done that. So just, they didn't have a clue that they didn't have a clue about that. So if you're waiting for some of them to ask you what it's like to be a young professional woman raising a family and what that means and what some of the challenges that you have, you better interrupt.
All right, so you've had my questions for half an hour. Now we get to have your questions, and Andy's gone through them and tried to pull together what so many people are asking. So we'll get started. The first one is, Dear Madam Speaker of the House, your full formal title, I am 14 years old and worried about our future in oil. What is your opinion of offshore drilling? And that comes from Paul, I think this is Sloats.
Hi, Paul. Paul, where's Paul? Thank you, Paul, for your question and for being here. For me, when I became Madam Speaker of the House, I had as my flagship issue the issue of energy security and reversing global warming. When I called the House to order, and it's on the back of the book, I did so for all of America's children. And to me, this was the issue for our society, for our country, for our future, was how we dealt with saving the planet, preserving the issue of reducing our dependence on foreign oil is a national security issue. It is an economic issue on how we can create new green jobs with new technologies and new green initiatives and renewable energy resources. It's a health issue in terms of how we protect the environment from the degradation of fossil fuels and the rest. And it is a moral issue if you believe, as do I, that this is God's creation, this planet, and we have a moral responsibility to preserve it. That's why we work closely with the evangelical community. The most conservative evangelicals sit at the table with us when we have these discussions because they believe this is God's garden, as they refer to it, and our moral responsibility there. And also they're on another track, which we share, which is as we do these initiatives, that we do so in a way that is not harmful to the poor, recognizing that some of these challenges could do that, and we had to take that into consideration. So for our security, our economy, our environmental health, and our moral responsibility to pass this planet on to the next generation better than we found it, it was essential that we take this as a core issue. And so we have two paths that we can go on. We can go on a path that reduces our dependence on foreign oil and on fossil fuels and say that our public policy should encourage the private sector, because this is about the private sector too, to invest in renewable energy resources, wind and solar and biofuels, and alternatives like natural gas, which are becoming more plentiful here in Pennsylvania, some big strikes, and therefore less expensive and much safer for the environment. We can do that, or we can say we want to continue down the path of the past, which is the same policies that got us here in the first place, which is the over $4 a gallon oil. And one of the ways that they're doing this is to say, we want to drill in protected, environmentally protected areas offshore. And we're saying, well, that's not the right thing to do for the following reason. First of all, it's a hoax on the American people. It does not provide any relief, maybe 10 cents, $10, excuse me, in 10 years, 2 cents. In 10 years, 2 cents. You never know it to hear the debate, do you? And that's the information from the White House, the administration's own Office of Energy Policy. 10 years, 2 cents. But they're selling it as we need to drill in protected areas to reduce the price at the pump. And so the American people are saying, well, then drill there. This other path says you can drill. There are 68 million acres in the United States in the lower 48, as we refer to it, the lower 48, 68 million acres, 33 million of it is offshore, and all of these are permitted. They're permitted. You can drill there. So use it. Don't lose it. If you have the permits, use it, or else let somebody else do it. We can also, and so here are the things we're saying to do instead of drilling in protected areas offshore, which are going to take, again, 10 years and 2 cents, and jeopardize the environment. We have something called the SPRO, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That is a stockpile of oil that the president is sitting on. And we're saying, free our oil. We paid for this oil with taxpayer dollars. Free our oil. If you release oil from that stockpile, it will increase the supply in the market, bring down the price at the pump in 10 days. In 10 days. In 10 days. But the administration doesn't want to do that because it wants to continue to give subsidies to big oil to drill in protected areas offshore. Okay, so we're saying free our oil. Use it, don't lose it. Drill where you can. And by the way, you want to drill in Alaska? Tens of billions, millions of acres in Alaska, billions of barrels of oil there. Not in the Arctic Refuge, which is a protected area, but in another area closer to the lower 48, as a matter of fact, where you can drill. So this is all a hoax that you can't drill, therefore the price at the pump is high. Okay, we're saying end undue speculation. Excessive speculation in the oil markets. Some speculation is very healthy for the market when it's geared to the commodity. Other speculation is very harmful. Let's figure out the difference. In any event, let's have transparency. Let's see what that is, which we don't have now. So free our oil, use it, don't lose it. End of speculation, invest in renewable energy resources, and use natural gas. Now, just to take the renewable versus the drilling, all of these things to succeed have to have a strong private sector, not just the public, the government saying this is a private sector attraction to capital. So if the government is saying we're coming down in favor of the environment, of renewables like wind and solar and biofuels and the rest, and so we're going to give tax credits to attract investment there, we will be creating new green industries in our country, be competitive internationally, and reduce our dependence on foreign oil and fossil fuels. If instead we take that money and give it in subsidies to the oil companies to drill in protected areas, we're just reinforcing the past, and we can be in the same situation over and over again and degrading the environment in the meantime. So what we're saying is, okay, do you want to talk about all these things? Let's talk about it. But over and over and over again, those whom I call the handmaidens of big oil do their dance of you know, it's going to help the consumer. It's not true. Even the president has had to admit it will not help the consumer in the short run. 10 years, 2 cents. So this is this for me is the fight of our generation. Now, do we have to carry some of this along? We'll see. I have to be sort of agnostic. I have to subject everything to maybe this can work. Maybe there's some progress being made here or there that I don't know about, but I'm open to hearing. But I haven't heard it yet. But the thing is that when they talk about you won't bring a bill to the floor, maybe you've heard that does this drill we brought so many bills to the floor for drilling, but they don't want to pass those. They want to get. So our fight is, and this is, we passed this in the first 100 hours, take the subsidies of big oil and give it instead to renewable energy resources. Big oil, the first five, we're targeting the five biggest oil companies, they have made record profits, over $11 billion in one quarter for Exxon Mobil. And so we're giving them subsidies to drill. They don't have enough profit motivation to do that. And mind you, $11 billion in one quarter for one company. All we're talking about for the whole year for these subsidies is $2 billion. And that's a lot of money, but not compared to their money. So listen carefully to what this debate is, because if you buy the bill of goods that we have to do more of the same, we'll be in the same situation. And, by the way, degrading the planet at the same time in terms of global warming. And so it's a fight. It's interesting to me because, you know, some of these news people keep saying, forgive me, but some of those of a particular point of view are saying, she won't allow a vote. Well, they're talking about one amendment. And I said, as soon as you can demonstrate that this reduces the price at the pump, I'm with you, even though I don't like it. But if it helps the consumer, because we have to increase the supply of oil to bring down the supply of energy. That includes renewables and everything else, but also to protect the consumer. But there is nothing in this for the consumer. This is all about big oil. It's too long a story to tell. It's easier just to say, drill, drill, drill. It's going to bring down the price, right? And people say, well, I'm for that. But I will tell you that I go right back to this, my flagship issue. I know that this is about our national security. It's about jobs. It's about health. It's about our moral responsibility. It's about it's about everything in our society. And we really have to make that fight. So I'm willing to take their barbs, especially when, and somebody will probably ask about the war. We have passed bills against to redeploy our troops out of Iraq safely, honorably, responsibly, and soon, over and over and over again across the board. We send them to the Senate, and every single time the Republicans in the Senate block that vote. This is about ending the war. This isn't about one amendment about drilling. This is about ending the war. Did you ever hear them saying to the Republicans in the Senate, let them vote to end the war? But on this thing, the power of big oil is big. They have a $300 million ad campaign on TV telling you how they're doing all this stuff for renewables. Well, there may be, maybe they're they make $40 billion in a year, and they spend $16 million with an M on renewables. So it's not, it's just not responsible. But again, it goes back to those special interests in Washington, D.C., and we've got to change that. And it's a fight. And sometimes it's hard for the public to understand why you make the fight. But you just have to try to find common ground as much as you can. We owe that to the American people. But where you can't find your common ground, you have to stand your ground. And this is a crossroads for our country. So that's what I think about oil and drilling offshore.
You've gotten a foreign policy question. The actual question is, do you think we should blockade Iran? Isn't this a danger that might be a prelude to war, which I think we should ask you the broader question that's debated in Washington. Do you think that there is a desire and a plan on the part of this administration to somehow engage Iran?
Engage? Or
well, engage as in opening up some sort of militarily.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that in the thank you for the question on Iran. I believe that in the administration, there is a debate going on as to whether we should consider a military strike into Iran. Most of the military opposes it. Even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has said, I don't need a third war. And it's not a good idea. For many reasons. But let's just take the issue about Iran first. Iran is insisting that it wants to proceed on developing nuclear power, they say, for domestic use. We suspect they have other motives. They cannot be allowed to do this. We cannot have a proliferation of nuclear weapons throughout the world because this is, you know, Iran has it, then somebody else has it, and somebody else has it. And Iran has when you talk about nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, you have to think of four things. You have to think of, do they have the technology? And they've gotten a lot of this technology from China, from Pakistan, from Russia, from other places. And that should never have happened. Do they have the scientific know-how to put this together? Do they have the delivery system? Do they have the missiles to deliver this thing? And do they have the intention? Do they have the intention? Intention is very important. Is it for civilian use? Is it just to show, you know, saber rattling for the neighbors in the region that they have this capability or could? And is it something that leaders want their people to think they have that strength? But do they have the intention of using it against another country? I hope for the best in terms of Iran. I suspect the worst. But I don't think anything is accomplished by going into Iran to stop them from developing a weapon of mass destruction, because I think it will only galvanize the public around the leadership that is advocating this, A. B, we may not accomplish the goal. That is to say, they may have parallel programs where we think we got it, but we didn't get it, or they got part of it and didn't get the rest, and what have we accomplished in terms of world opinion at the same time? Instead, what we should be doing, and they're trying to do this more, but we should have done it more robustly, much sooner, is to say to Iran, don't even think about having a weapon of mass destruction. And we are galvanizing the world, international, global forces, diplomatically, economically, culturally, in every way, financially, in addition to economically, financially, to have sanctions that will tighten and tighten and tighten if you proceed down this course. But it involves everybody. You can't just have some countries. And the president of Iran said, those people are against me. I have many other friends. Well, if those friends want to be friends of Iran, then we can't have them be friends of ours, because our pillar of our foreign policy is that we cannot permit the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And they are a danger in the neighborhood. So we have to say to their friends, we want everybody to be friends, but we absolutely have to prevent this, and you have to help us do that. So I'm not supportive the question is, if you think they're developing a weapon of mass destruction, do you support a military strike into Iran? No. But I do support the most robust diplomacy to do it. The president assures me every time I ask him that this is what he is doing. I just don't want him to do a token robust diplomacy to say, well, that didn't work. It has to be real. And the Secretary of Defense has assured me over and over again, Secretary Gates, he has written about this, that it's not a good idea before he became secretary, and I think he is an advocate against a military strike at this time. We really don't need this. Let me just say, this war in Iraq, now going to Iraq for a moment, this war in Iraq was a tremendous blunder, a grotesque mistake, a fault. We went into that war knowing full well there was no intelligence to support the imminent threat that this administration was contending. I was a senior Democrat on the Intelligence Committee at the time. There's called the Gang of Four, the top Democrat and top Republican in the House and in the Senate. And we saw all of the intelligence. And there was no intelligence to say that there was an imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction from Iraq. It was clear. I voted against the war. 60% of the House Democrats voted against the war, even though our leader, I was with, the leader went to the Rose Garden and supported it. So it was, even with that, we had a majority, well, a strong majority of the Democrats again. But in the Senate, the chairman, you know, so you say, oh, you're from San Francisco. I'm so proud to be from San Francisco. You're from San Francisco. You would be against the war. Anyway, I said, no, I wasn't. If anybody, think of me as a lioness. You come near my cubs, you're dead. So, you know, anybody is a threat to the United States, we have to deal with, and we have to make sure they understand that. So, but I read all the intelligence, and I knew that it wasn't there. Senator Graham, who was the Democrat in the Senate, the chairman of the committee, because at that time, for a short period, the Democrats were in control over there. And they, moderate to conservative senator from Florida, read the same intelligence that I did, and he voted against the war. So the administration knew all this faulty intelligence stuff. They knew it wasn't there, but it was like drill. It was just an excuse for a policy that they wanted to do anyway. And so this war has taken its toll. For over 4,100 people lost, 1,000 since the surge began, tens of thousands injured, many thousands of them permanently. A third of the people who've been there, over 1.1 million people have served there, a third of them seeking mental health counseling. 300,000 of them already considered to have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, loss in our reputation in the world to deal with the Irans of the world, because they say, well, what's your intelligence that they're doing this? The loss of reputation to stop proliferation, to fight terrorism, to end global warming, to alleviate poverty, to eradicate disease, to be the leader that we are and the world needs us to be. And again, affecting our ability to fight the war on terrorism where it really exists in Afghanistan. And then this is why some of the hawks, like Mr. Murtha of Pennsylvania, are so strongly for redeploying our troops out of Iraq. This has harmed our military readiness, our capability to meet threats and face threats to our U.S. interests wherever they may occur. This is damage. There isn't one combat-ready unit in the United States should we need to send a unit someplace. Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has said, I need troops in Afghanistan. They're tied up in Iraq. And so this has not been for our safety and national security has not been served by this. It has not made the region more stable. It is a tremendous cost to the American people and the lives and limbs and of our and long haul cost to families, breakup of marriage, domestic. It is so painful to see and to meet these families all the time and see what they are going through. God bless our military. They have done their job, our men and women in uniform, magnificently. Everything they have been asked to do. They need a new commander-in-chief to follow a new policy.
And I would imagine that it's feelings about the war in Iraq that led to this question, which is, are you going to allow a motion to impeach President Bush to come to the floor? If no, why? And I'm sure you will answer that. But that sort of outrage, in the book you have a couple of anecdotes, the call from Condoleezza Rice, and you say, why are you going in so quickly the night before the strikes in Baghdad? You also talk about engaging the president and saying, Mr. President, what are you going to do with the Arab world? And he says, the problem's not the Arab world, it's the French. And this all occurs... It all occurs before the election in 2004. That anecdote came from May of 2003, which leads me to something Bob Dole used to say on the stump all the time. Where is the outrage? With all of this out there, why do you think the Democrats lost in 2004? A lot of this information was out 4 years ago.
Yeah. You're talking about the election of 2004. Well, I'd really like to look forward to the election of 2008. But, again, I think that I really do think that our candidate, John Kerry, as excellent as he was, did not realize how vicious the attacks would be on him and did not inoculate against them. And in the politics, you have to inoculate against, doctor. You inoculate against the attack, and then you educate about another position afterward. So I think that he didn't take seriously enough the swift boat attacks on him. Imagine we have a president of the United States with unknown and dubious military credentials, and we have a bona fide hero, and they flip it. It's jujitsu. Now, that's what we have to be careful of in this election, because we get back to the power in the title, Know Your Power, Women. Power, and for the Republicans, I hate to do this in this library, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but they will do anything to keep power because it's about money. It's about special interest money. So they've got to win at any cost, and they have endless money that is not reportable because of these, the way they do this. Mark knows how they do this, and to put that out there. So let's just say that John McCain is not a party to that. He's an honorable person, and hopefully he will honor the dignity of the office that he is running for by keeping the debate at a certain level. So far, I don't know. But let's hope. Let's hope. Because nothing less is at stake than the highest office in the land. This is you're not only the president of the United States, you're the leader of the world that people are looking to for leadership. You're the president of the United States, a country that from this place in Philadelphia, this band of people came together and they did something that the world had never seen. They declared independence based, predicated on an idea new, a new idea that all men are created equal. They risk their lives, their limbs, their sacred honor in order to fight the biggest naval power in the history of the world. They fought the War of Independence and they won and they wrote a declaration, the greatest document for freedom in the world, in the Bill of Rights. Thank God they made it amendable so we could expand that freedom. But this was remarkable, predicated on equality of people. And they did this with all the confidence in the world here in Philadelphia. And at the same time, they did a great seal of the United States. God blessed us so with our founders. It's a great seal of the United States. And on it, it says, Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order for the centuries, or for the ages, however your Latin translation is, forever. So confident they were in what they had done. And when they did this, they did it with all the optimism, the hope, the faith in the future. Faith, faith, faith. I talk a lot about faith. Faith in the future. And it was predicated on the idea that every generation had a responsibility to make the future better for the next generation. And that became known as the American Dream. And people flocked to our shores. And when they came here from Italy or Ireland or Germany or wherever they came from this hemisphere now, they made America more American because they brought their determination to make the future better for the next generation of their families. And so this American dream that the future would always be better for the next generation was the way it always was, and that's what people always believed until now. Now there's a thought, and the statistics are showing, that some families believe that the future will hold less for their children. But as Speaker of the House and Democratic Speaker of the House, first woman, mom, Speaker of the House, we can't subscribe to that. We cannot subscribe to that. We have to reverse that and take us to a new direction for our country to restore. The change that is being talked about is a change to restore the American dream. Not change that is menacing, but change that is renewing in terms of the American dream. And so that's why our agenda when we go in January, because people always ask this, is about how we keep the American people safe, our first responsibility. We begin by redeploying our troops out of Iraq. How we provide health care for all Americans. Too bad we don't have time to go into all of that. To make health care affordable, reliable, health care accessible to all Americans. How we grow our economy so that many more people participate in the prosperity of our country by creating new, good, great jobs and through innovation, through building the infrastructure of America, and through the new green technologies we use to preserve the planet and reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And in all of these areas, the innovation, it depends on education, education, education. Educate, innovate, compete, prevail, keep America number one. All of this, innovation, the science for rebuilding the infrastructure of America, the engineering and technological advances that we need, and preserving the planet, all of that, and, of course, healthcare. all of it depend on a major, I just remember these four words when you think of what we're going to do next. Science, 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 and science. That is going to lead the way for us. And we will make Washington a city no longer where it's faith or science. Take your pick. This, we recognize them as both as searches for truth, searches for truth that will take our country in the direction that our founders, these magnificent disruptors that I write about, they disrupted what was happening. We have to continue in the tradition of magnificent disruption, and one way for that to happen is for women to know their power. Thank you all so much.
And we want to thank you. We want to thank all of you for coming out. Speaker Pelosi will be signing books upstairs, but let's give her another round of applause.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.